This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. John Cleese is a comedy legend. Among his many credits, he's a founding member of Monty Python, co-creator and star of the sitcom Fawlty Towers, also wrote and co-starred in the film A Fish Called Wanda, and it just takes a moment to bring his work to mind.
This parrot is no more. It has ceased to be. It's expired and gone to meet its maker. This is a late parrot.
John Cleese is still at it after decades of writing and performing for the stage, movies, and television. Most recently, he was on tour with his one-man show, Last Time to See Me Before I Die. But in fact, it was not the last time. This evening, he will be at the Durham Performing Arts Center for a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, followed by a Q&A with the audience. But first, John Cleese, welcome to the State of Things. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Nice of you to let me on your show to try and sell tickets.
Well, I hope it goes well. Listen, I want to talk to you about what you're up to these days, but while the parrot sketch is still fresh in our minds, I think you and Graham Chapman wrote it, but I understand that it was actually based on an experience that Michael Palin had with a used car salesman. Is that true?
Well, yes. So Michael told us once about this experience he'd had with a used car salesman. He bought the car, there was something wrong with it, and he brought it in. And so, says, sticky gearbox, Mr. Palin, because this was many years ago. Sticky gear was a sign of a top-class car, always, just for the first 50,000 miles, you see. Whatever Michael said, he would say, "Will you have any trouble bringing it in? Just bring it in, Mr. Palin." And Michael said, "Well, I am having trouble, but I have brought it in." The man says, "Yeah, well, as I say, you just do that." He was so slippery. We thought he was a funny character. So Graham and I wrote a sketch about him, but it wasn't terribly good when we did it, and very few people saw it. And I said to Graham, "There's something funny about this sketch, and it's the salesman." He said, "Yeah, what could it be if it's not a garage?" And after a short time, we said, "It's a pet shop." And then we argued about what animal it should be if it was damaged, or then we decided dead was funny because damaged could mean the animal was not, was in pain. And then we thought, well, it can't be a cat or a dog because people like them too much and they'd be too worried about a dead cat. Isn't really funny, particularly people like me who are crazy about cats. And then one of us, who can't remember who, came up with a parrot, which was perfect because nobody likes parrots. People who own parrots don't like them. So there's no chance anyone's going to get offended.
Plus, you can nail them to the perch. You really can't do that with a dog, can you?
No, absolutely. That's right. Otherwise, they zoom up to those bars and zoom.
Let's talk more.
Right. I'm very fond of that sketch.
Let's talk about the process, too, and to me, the revolutionary style and what happened to sketch comedy when Monty Python hit the airwaves. How did you come up with this idea of these non sequiturs and these quick edits where things, suddenly the sketch just stops right there, and then we now it's time for something different?
I think, when people start doing things, there's a phase where they're exploring, which is always exciting and fun. And then there's a phase where they sort of settle into a set way of doing things, which in a way becomes a bit of a cliche. And I think it's true, for example, of the more serious and straight news programs. I think one of the reasons people get so much of their political information out from late-night comedians is that the straight political programs are very formulaic. You know what's going to happen, And they also don't ask certain questions because they're too dangerous. They have to sort of stay within certain parameters or else it might get a little bit too edgy. So I think that what we were doing was the same in comedy. We got fed up with certain conventions that you had to go to the end of the sketch and then someone had to say a punchline and then the band had to play a few chords. we were just fed up with it. But I think a very good reason why people become creative is they get fed up with what's gone before. I think when the Impressionists came along, and there were all these academicians painting, very precisely, very, very accurately, but not full of life. And all of a sudden, the Impressionists come along and say, "No, we see things differently," because they were bored with the old way. And I think that that's what keeps art in particular alive.
I can see how you as artist would get fed up and want to come up with something new and fresh and even better. But what about selling that to the BBC? I mean, that, after all, is a corporation and pretty straight-laced.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And the fact was, we were very, very lucky. I mean, the six of us trotted into a meeting with a guy called Michael Mills, who's the head of BBC Light Entertainment Television. And he asked us what we were proposing to do, because he'd heard we wanted to do a series, and we were we hadn't discussed it. We just wanted to do a series. And he should have said, go away for 3 months and come back with a proper proposal. And he looked at us as we sort of stammered, and it became perfectly clear we had no idea what we were going to do. And he said, go away and make 13 programs. And I think that was exactly why it was so original, because we didn't know what we were going to do. If we'd gone in there with something that was carefully prepared, which is, of course, that's what the bureaucrats
like. Right.
That's what the executives like, because they want all the, we want all the plots down so that they can decide whether the plots work or not, as though they have any idea. They have no idea, these executives. They have no idea what they're doing, but they have no idea that they have no idea what they're doing.
Still, pretty bold move to say, bold move to say, go ahead and make the shows instead of go away and come back prepared so I can cover my. Wow.
It was astonishing. And most of the other people in the building at the BBC didn't like it. There was a meeting after about 6 weeks of it being transmitted, and out of 8 heads of department. You know, there was head of drama, head of news, head of sport, head of children's programs, head of light. Six out of 8 of them didn't like Python. These are people who make programs for a living. It's often thought of as one of the most creative and original comedy programs of all time. And 6 out of 8, the BBC heads of department didn't like it. So that's what you're up against. I mean, we sold the rights for 40 Towers, my sitcom set in a hotel, 3 times to Americans, who always thought they knew exactly how to make it work in America. It was always a disaster. And the third time I heard, I thought, oh, God, here we go again. And I said to the people who bought the rights of 40 Towers, I said, have you made any changes? And they said, only one. I said, oh, that's good. What was that? They said, we've written Basil out. So these people are complete incompetence, but they've no idea that they are incompetence, because they don't know what competence would be. And a lot of competence in creativity is saying, we don't know what's going to happen. Because if you try and make it predictable, oh, yes, this will be a success, then you can only do that by copying something in the past. So you can't be original.
There's originality, but also, I mean, I think maybe you would agree that nothing, even for artists, is sui generis, that to some extent there is some kind of... Did this come a full?
No, I said you're right. No, I said you're absolutely right. Nothing's completely fresh. We had a fellow called Spike Milligan who did a show called Q3, and I remember watching it about 3 months before we started Python, and I rang up Terry Jones, and I said, did you watch Q3 just now? He said, yes, I did. I said, I thought that's what we were going to do. He said, so did I. So there's always someone there beating the track ahead of you.
And what about the Goon Show, Spike Milligan's Goon Show on the radio? Did you listen to
that? That's right. That was for my generation, that was what Monty Python was for a lot of people later on. In the mid-50s, we'd come in, it was a radio show, we'd come in the morning to school, you know, and we'd all discuss the previous night's program and, you know, try to remember what the jokes were and recollect it and do the silly voices. It was exactly like how people felt about Python, 15 years later.
Python is produced in England, I think, it starts in 1968. So this is the rise of the counterculture. Python, for many fans, was seen as part of that counterculture revolution. And I was shocked to read, here's the quote, this is John Cleese, quote, I didn't quite understand the assumption that I had an affinity for the counterculture.
Oh, interesting. No, I don't. That's right. I don't think I was particularly interested in the counterculture, and I didn't know much about what it meant. I probably would have agreed with a lot of it, but it was like a manifesto that I hadn't read. Do you see what I mean? But that's right. I think we shared a lot of attitudes, but there were also attitudes we didn't share. I mean, I'm not against authority. I'm only against authority that's being very badly exercised. I think we need traffic lights. I think we need someone to say, no, this column of cars has got to stop. And that's a form of authority. And if authority is exercised intelligently and for the benefit of the general population, then it's a good thing. If it's just people stacking up their own bank accounts like Dick Cheney, then it's appalling.
I want to talk more about this genealogy and what happens to the ethos and the aesthetic of, if I may, Monty Python. Because I understand there was a German production company that came to you and said, "Well, we'd like to do Python in Germany." tell us about that, because it's kind of a funny story about how all that came about and what it was they were expecting of you.
There's two stories, but they got a little bit muddled there. They came to us and they said, "We would like you to come to Germany and make a film." A filmed comedy show of an hour in German, in the language, to sort of introduce your kind of humor to Germany. And we did that, and it was well-liked. They asked us to do another one, but that one they wanted to do in English, and they dubbed it, because only two of us, Michael and I, spoke German that people immediately understood. The others had accents that made it more difficult. But what also happened was that many, many years later, the Germans bought the rights to Fawlty Towers and made an episode. They invited me over, and I watched rehearsals and the recording, and they were absolutely excellent. It was a very, very – I speak enough German to be able to sort of follow it. And I thought they were marvelously good performers, but unfortunately, the people in charge – decided it was too expensive, and that was the end of that. But they actually did it very well on that occasion.
I guess the other story that I heard was that they said, you know, we don't want that. At some point, somebody came and said, "Well, all we want to do is buy the format." And you looked at each other and said, "Well, we don't."
Well, that happened. That happened three times in America.
Yeah.
Yes, three times they bought the format of Fawlty Towers. I don't remember anyone trying to buy the format of Monty Python. It would be so hard to say what the format was. I don't think one could copyright that format.
Let's talk about your film career, too. You wrote and starred in A Fish Called Wanda. That could have been the beginning of a film career for you. Could it have been? Did you like performing in films? Did you like Hollywood? And would you like to have pursued that career?
Well, I think one of the sadnesses of my life is when I go back to a moment when I became a minor film star. I was in the swimming pool at the Four Seasons Hotel in L.A., and a man brought a mobile phone, which in those days weighed about 20 pounds. And he gave it to me sitting in the pool, and my old friend Frank Oz, who I knew well from London when they'd been making the Muppet shows in London, offered me a part opposite Steve Martin in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And I so much regret that I couldn't do it, but I couldn't do it because my second marriage was in such a mess. And I'd been on the road for 3 months doing publicity. I thought I got to go back to England and find out whether this marriage is going to work or not. So I had to say no to Frank because I didn't really feel I could leave my wife or ex-wife to be in a state of suspension for months where I went off to make a movie. And I've always regretted that moment, but I think it was the right decision.
Well, you're still doing pretty well, I would say, still touring and been
on
Broadway.
Well, the finances, as you know, the finances of a business change all the time, Frank. Mm. And you really have to change with them. I mean, there used to be a very good living to be made, television and videos. And then people found ways of really not paying proper copyright payments on the internet. And now live touring is the safest way to make money because people can't see it if they don't come to the theater and buy tickets. And I like that. I love there's something about a live performance in the theater that it's very real. You know, it's what it is. It's not dependent on technology.
I'm going to just one more question, if you don't mind, and that is just
sure.
whether or not for you humor has changed or your approach to humor.
Yes, I think it has changed. I think it's got more risky over the years. I mean, it was very safe in the 50s. You know, American television seemed very bland, and English television was very little better. But I think it's now much edgier. I think the problem now is there isn't a very high level of general knowledge among the audience, so that the references that are made, the joke about a very limited number of subjects, and particularly so far as movies go, because it's only young men who go to the cinema anymore, particularly in the opening weekend. And you finish up with Hangover, which is the sort of result of an audience that doesn't really know much except for stuff about drugs and drink and gambling and celebrities and sex. I would like to make a film about 1776, but all my American friends talked me out of that 20 years ago. They said, John, people don't know enough about it. Yeah. You can't make jokes about it because they won't understand them.
Wow. Sad truth, comedy legend John Cleese, thank you so much for talking with us.
Lovely to talk to you.
John Cleese will be on stage at the Durham Performing Arts Center for a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, followed by a Q&A with his audience. He is, of course, the co-creator of Monty Python, Fawlty Towers, A Fish Named Wanda, and much, much more. We leave you with a bit of a sample before we say goodbye.
No, I'm afraid we couldn't accept your dog instead of your youngest child. We would like to suggest a brand new scheme of ours under which 51% of both your dog and your wife pass to us in the event of your suffering a serious accident.
Oh, and enough, eh? Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look!
It's just a flesh wound.
I'm invincible!
Stilton?
Sorry.
Gruyere, Emmental?
No.
Any Norwegian Jarlsberger?
No! No, I am not the brain specialist! No! No, I am not! Yes! Yes, I am!
He's out distributing pamphlets to the masses, but he'll be in at 6.
Oh, 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 we want to learn how to defend ourselves against pointed sticks, do we? Getting all iron mighty, eh? Fresh fruit not good enough for you, eh? Oh, 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 well, I'll tell you something, my lad. When you're all walking home tonight and some homicidal maniac comes after you, well, a bunch of Loganberries don't come crying to me!
Is this a piece of your brain?
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
And so, you see, the idiot does provide a vital psychosocial service for this community.
Oh, an ugly ramble!
Monty Python's a flying circus!
The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.